Hi there, and thank you for joining me for what I promise to be a truly dynamic conversation. This episode is our kickoff for a series of podcasts spotlighting the Arizona Institutes for Resilience at the University of Arizona and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change, and perhaps most importantly, find new opportunities and impactful solutions when it comes to solving the climate crisis. We're talking about a roadmap to resilience. What does it look like? What does it take to create collaborative partnerships that produce real solutions addressing climate change, and then build resilient communities and quickly? You're about to find out. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. So this is definitely one of those where do I begin moments, because what I know is that this series really matters. It's both a story about how human beings inside a very large institution made real change happen for the greater good. And it's also a story about how much of the work of the Arizona Institutes for Resilience is essential for our global success, and I'm going to add, maybe even survival as a planet. Please join me in welcoming Dr. James Beiser, Interim Director, Arizona Institutes for Resilience, Professor, School of Natural Resources and the Environment, Research Scientist, Arid Lands Resource Sciences Program, and graduate interdisciplinary program in global change faculty. In short, Jim is the airhead behind all of this, and I just had to say that. It's great to have you here, my friend, but you are the force, and we've been looking forward to this and working hard to make it happen for a long time. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gina, for having me here today.
So I really want to dive in. But I think we should get this right up front that you would want to acknowledge. I read all of the really wonderful things you've accomplished and how you are a force behind this. But you have said to me many times that I want to put it out there because I know a lot of our friends will be listening. You are always the first to say nothing happens without the help, support, and contributions of many other major players at the U of A and other places who are all a part of this AIR initiative. Does that capture it, my friend?
No, absolutely. And in fact, I just happen to be the one that's fortunate enough to play a leadership role. But the people that do the real work are all of the people that you were referring to.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with you about that, but maybe someday we will, over cocktails. And I did get a warning from our executive show producer, Kelly King, who knows us both so well. And her last words were, will you two try to stay on track and keep tangents to a minimum? So let's see how we do. I think the most important thing in this first episode is that we lay the foundation or set the table or lay the groundwork or whatever you want to call it by sharing with us the inspiration behind AIR. It was a lot of months in the planning, and I'd like you to take us back to the early stages of its creation. Why AIR? Why does it matter?
Sure. I'll avoid the temptation to do a play on words as to why AIR matters, and I will just go ahead and answer the question that you asked. The Arizona Institutes for Resilience is actually the brainchild of a group of people led by our Senior Vice President for Research, Innovation, and Impacts, Dr. Betsy Cantwell, here at the University of Arizona. In November of 2019, she formed a design committee for environment to rethink how we are organized in order to meet the challenges that we are facing. And so in November of 2019, she asked me to chair a small committee of faculty and deans to rethink the organizational structure, particularly focused around research, the institutes and centers that report to Betsy, and it completely framed around the concept of resilience.
A lot of what I try to do is inspire people to action. So Betsy obviously inspired you and others. Where did that inspiration come from? What was the impetus? Was it inefficiencies in the system at the U of A? Was it the clear and present danger of climate change? Was it a need for reorganization? From your perspective, what was the need for AIR?
Well, I would say it was all of the above, because we do face a crisis, a climate crisis, and what we should keep in mind is that our systems, our social, our economic, our environmental systems, have been relatively resilient over time. And that's because the changes that have happened haven't necessarily been shocks that couldn't be withstood. And what's happening now is that we've seen, in fact, we can use the pandemic as an example, that our systems aren't quite as resilient. In fact, they're more fragile than we thought before. With the impending impacts, severe impacts of global environmental change and global climate change, the framing of the challenge to be able to prepare our communities and our planet, frankly, with the kind of knowledge that is necessary to be able to withstand the shocks, if you will, to our system, need to be better understood.
And putting a lot of brain power together is easier. And I will not belabor this, but let's face it, U of A, like most other universities, they're steeped in tradition, in doing things the way they've always been done. And things can be political at any university, let's be honest. There's always the issue of how money will be spent. What did it take to create an entirely new paradigm, a new construct? And how did you get others to join you and bring it to life? Because it happened, and it didn't happen over a 5-year plan. She talked to you in 2019, and it's the beginning of 2021, and you're up and running in the midst of a pandemic. So what do you think, what were some of the magic parts of that that made it happen? Magic, hard work, compromise. What were some of the things that we can have other people understand what it takes to make real change happen?
Well, we were actually ready. What Dr. Cantwell did was she arrived relatively recently. She's been here 18 months. And shortly after she arrived, she looked at the centers and institutes that had been created over the years, in fact, decades, at the university, and had done so for different reasons at different times. What she was looking at was a snapshot of what was there and asking herself, why aren't these institutes and centers and programs under one umbrella, under one constellation? And so that's what she asked us to do, is consider a restructuring, because it is understood, as you mentioned, that when people are working together, different kinds of the outcomes happen, usually better outcomes. And so the theory behind this was, we have well over 300 researchers, world-renowned researchers at the University of Arizona. We know about the water researchers. In fact, we're ranked number one globally as a university in water. But there are many other areas and disciplines and fields related to resilience where we have real experts. And like everywhere else, the people are working with the folks in their departments, in their institutes, in their centers, but very little was really happening across them. So in looking at that, what better place than the University of Arizona to really kickstart that? It just was a matter initially of an organization, reorganization of a framing of a vision. And then, frankly, what is the sort of magic that can happen is if particularly when we got hit right about the time that we were charged with moving forward with pandemic-related issues like working remotely, frankly, like a tightening of resources, a dramatic tightening of resources available. So however, and we still do, is the absolute genuine and enthusiastic backing by President Bobby Robbins and Dr. Cantwell and other senior leadership. And that really matters. That is a critical ingredient. I've been either redesigning or transforming or creating new institutional frameworks my entire career. And that is one of the critical ingredients for success.
And it's like, it's a big wham. And you know, when I was looking on the website many times and thinking about how do you describe it? What's the mission? And one of the things stuck out, and anybody who's ever designed a website or created a new institution or started a business knows word storing all of these things is really important. And a line jumped out at me. Looking to the future, AIR will help individuals, businesses, and communities manage risk and find opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis. And that's really succinct. It's like, it is managing risk. It is coming together. So to me, all of those ingredients, it was all captured in, I think, what the vision is. So do you want to add anything as far as the mission and vision of AIR? Because you are the Pied Piper.
No, not necessarily, other than because of how we are and how we are organized, and because we have the real luxury of sitting within the this amazing university, we should recognize that what we really are doing is serving to fill gaps where gaps exist. So fill them with projects, with ideas, with vision. Fill it with people and work and programs, fill it with opportunities for faculty and students, in other words, serve the entire university. We don't fit into a particular college. We actually work with every single one of the colleges. We have collaborative programs with people from every college across the university.
And as you know, and as we have talked about many times, a lot of climate action, climate research, addressing climate change, a lot of it happens in silos. You have specialists, you have people that are concerned about energy and about AIR and about water. And to me, the inspiration behind this and why our team took it so seriously and really dedicated ourselves to the process of what we want this series to translate to our listeners, to me, was all about that. It's about an integration of thought and action and combined resources. So you would think that I'm the spokesperson for AIR, so I better put a pin in it for a minute. But when you and I talked, we talked about what I would call deliverables in my world. What the work of AIR is all about, what you want to deliver in whatever you're producing. And I would like you to try help us bring them to life. These are concepts that I think are essential for our global success. So let's go through them a little bit more slowly. Finding solutions. That's one of the top ones that we talked about. What do you mean finding solutions? Isn't that what all your work is about?
It is, and I can give you some examples, fairly recent examples of solutions. And we'll use the pandemic that we're still in as an example, because it's very real and salient for the people that are listening. When we think of, for example, when we think of living in a world that continues to have exposure to novel coronaviruses, which I think we all should be prepared for. I'm not saying everyone should stay in their homes for the rest of our lives and wearing masks, but we should be prepared. And why should we? Well, think about it. There are other coronaviruses we've been living with, the common flu, as an example. The difference being, without going into a lot of detail, but the difference between being the impact that it has and the fact that we have not been prepared for this particular virus. So let's just think about how can we do this and how might we build our buildings and build our transportation systems so that we can live and thrive in a future environment that we are sharing, frankly, with some of these viruses. So that the concept of the design for that, and using the technologies that exist and the thinking that exists to be able to do that kind of thing. And that would be a specific example. Another really about around students is preparing the students so that they actually know how to think about these kinds of things and then provide them with the, equip them with the ways to hope and imagine pursue and frankly form coalitions of the enthusiastic to be able to move beyond where we are. Some of us felt a little bit frozen at the very beginning. We didn't know how to handle it. There was a shock to our system at the beginning of this pandemic. And as time went, we realized that we're going to have to pull our, I've heard you say before, Gina, put our big boy pants on and get with it.
You have heard me say that. And it's like, we're finally doing it after a little bit of a break.
Indeed.
But, you know, your point is, to me, it brings it back to the integration of knowledge and action, because that's how you find really good solutions. It's not in your silo in your lab. It's finding what you found and then sharing it with others and see what they found, and the beat goes on. When you and I talked maybe even last summer in preparation for this, one of the things that you wrote down that I put in quotes and underline, and I said to you, what the heck does that mean, Jim? Creating new knowledge. You don't hear that phrase. So what do you mean by that?
That's actually what all of us as researchers are doing. So when we do our research, we're actually creating new knowledge. In fact, it's one way that, it's how academics and scientists, researchers, we do our business, is we experiment, because we ask ourselves questions that there is no current answer to, and then we design our work to be able to inform those questions and fill those knowledge gaps. And that's what I mean when I talk about creating new knowledge.
But you don't hear it a lot, and I loved it, and I think it's a phrase I'll use. It's just you're on the cusp of discovery and finding things that we didn't even know, so thus new knowledge. Another thing you talked about is, and it's all through the AIR messaging, is creating a future. If you're you, if you're me, if you're a lot of climate scientists, there are days when you think the future is not particularly bright. And I don't mean tomorrow, but down the road a little bit. But you and your team and the other people in the institutes, they're working to create a future. So can you elaborate on that a little bit? It excited me and gave me hope.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Because our orientation is about solutions, and we should remember what universities do, right? Our mission is, in fact, to create new knowledge through research. It is, in fact, to create solution options to issues and problems and challenges. It's also, as an educational institution, first and foremost, it's about creating the new generations of leaders and thinkers and doers. And we believe that at the university, that our way of doing that will prepare these people to be able to focus their attention on solution options. Universities don't actually implement solutions, frankly, not the kinds that we're talking about, not solutions to grand challenges. That happens by influencing policy. That happens by having products go into market. So for the grander population, say our nation, our state, or the world, to pick something up and actually apply it, that requires innovative partnerships between the university, between our faculty and our students. Requires the kind of work together, what some of us call transdisciplinarity, of working together for solutions. It's not, all new knowledge does not come from universities. It's when we bring the knowledge sets and the ways of thinking together frankly, we're pretty innovative when we need to be.
And the thing that you say, and that I've heard other people on your team say, is it's critical for the university to go outside of that street, cross the street, and work with businesses and communities to help manage this risk. You're not doing it in the abstract and in the research framework. It's going out into the communities, which is a perfect segue to my next question. I think one of the biggest challenges we face today and will continue to face for a bit is a prepared workforce. I mean, Jim, think about it. Everything has changed. You know, my granddaughter, Rooney, she knows how to do things on a phone, and she mostly tries to steal her mother's phone because she's 20 months old. Her mother doesn't want her on the phone. But she knows how to get to things. She knows how to push the Netflix button, right? She's not even 20 months old. She's going to be more prepared for a different workforce. But what are you doing to help prepare people for the workforce, especially with the number of people we have unemployed that are going to need new skills? What the heck are you going to do? How are you going to make this all get better, Jim Beiser?
Mm-hmm. Well, that has to happen through the partnerships. There are so many different kinds of skills and jobs that are necessary. And you're right, the kinds of jobs and skills needed going forward, we never even imagined 20 years ago. In fact, we didn't even imagine that we were going to be teaching all remotely at this point. And we've adjusted to that. And so one of the things that I think is critically important for us as a university to be thinking about is, what is the future of education? We're in the business of not just educating people to be looking like us. In fact, I think I saw a statistic that about 60% of U of A graduates don't go beyond a bachelor's degree. So they graduate with a bachelor's from the University of Arizona and don't go beyond. And those of us who are faculty have. And we need to remember that most of the people that we're teaching are not going to have jobs like our own. And so we need to be really good about the kind of skill sets that are necessary. I'd like to see us, for example, spend more time talking with the potential employers, talking with folks that are seeing what the future might look like, so that we are in fact teaching our students to be ready for that workforce rather than for the workforce of the decade past.
And what they're going to need. I mean, it's just skill set. And I crack up, and you know me really well. And all of a sudden, I'm on this team and we have to learn about Monday.com. And I make jokes about, I wasn't even on the Sunday page. And then, oh, we have to get on Slack. We're doing all of that on Slack. And even though it's kind of a funny, comparison on my part, it's all new skill sets. It's not using Outlook and Google Docs, constantly changing in the technological world. So when you take a heavier lift with all of the scientific components to that, there's miles to go before we sleep. And it comforts me that it's a really key component of what AIR wants to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the big $64,000 question. One of them. Why didn't you call it the Arizona Institutes of Sustainability? Why? Well, then it might be AS, but AIR really matters. It's resilience. And I know that in interviewing scientists like you and spending time with people like you and Kathy Jacobs and a bunch of other people, they're not talking a lot about sustainability anymore. It's about resilience. Would you agree? And what created that shift?
Well, if I was not being recorded, what I would say is, been there, done that.
Dave can take it out.
I already led the establishment of a sustainability institute in a little university up in Tempe. So
sorry.
They actually, and I'm going to push back a little bit, because to me, resilience and sustainability are really two interrelated concepts. They're not. It's not an either or. It's not a sort of a competition as to who gets the latest spotlight. It's not, in fact, either one of them is, in fact, a new concept. And here's what I mean. To me, resilience is about robustness, about withstanding shocks, and as we mentioned, about managing risks. Full stop there. Let's talk about sustainability. Sustainability is much more focused on how we treat the planet and each other.
Okay.
So that we can have a long-term relationship where our extraction of resources, the use of resources that our system gives us, and our treatment of each other means that we can be around for a long time. It doesn't necessarily address how do we fortify our system to withstand shocks. So I don't see them as an either or. I actually see them both as important concepts and important work. So let's think about this. In sustainability, We want to make sure that what we are addressing includes things like plastics in the ocean. Okay. I don't need to tell you because you know this very well, and you've interviewed some people about the huge problem with plastics. And we could address that problem, and we would address it, and we do address it in when we're working in sustainability, we address those issues. But it isn't about a shock of this of that piece of the system that resilience would be working on. Yes, it's all very, very important, but much more. And an example of resilience, again, going back to the pandemic, I, for one, am, and you might say, well, this is a privileged white guy perspective, but I thought of the U.S. Medical delivery system as being, frankly, quite resilient, until, what, a year ago, 14 months ago? And then look what happened, right?
Yes.
Would anyone argue that our system is resilient? It's bent. It's broken in some places. A resilient system, a delivery resilient health delivery system would not deliver to us over 410,000 dead. No. So no criticism there of the people working on it by any means. My daughter's a nurse. I know the struggles that she has to go through every single day watching people die of COVID. But the system as a whole wasn't resilient to the shock that we didn't anticipate. So that's what I see in, as far as resilience and sustainability, really two a partner kind of interrelated concepts.
So it's like we rehearsed this and we really didn't. We just talk to each other a lot. About 4 months ago, we got a call from Habitat for Humanity Tucson asking us if we would be willing to partner with them to do a series of workshops on resilience to facilities managers. We're talking about on the ground, make it happen, facilities managers for 13 homeless shelters. And you know how we love training. We love to bring about long-term systemic change. And we were like, sure, we don't know what that looks like yet, but yes. So we've been working on this partnership, and I kind of want to just bring it down to like one example of the brainstorming. We live in the desert Southwest, and it's not just about having a water audit on your property. If the water gets turned off and if there's a drought, and this pandemic has highlighted it so much, Jim, because of the need for homeless people to wash and wash and wash and wash. But how do you... Do you look at putting in rainwater harvesting? Do you look at if the air conditioning goes out because of a power outage, how do you ensure that your facility is going to be livable and not 115 degrees? And that might involve planting trees around it. How do you build community? And would it help with your residents if there was a community garden? I mean, and we are creating with Habitat for Humanity and other shelters thinking outside of the box because their jobs are hard. So to me, when you talk about that on the ground level and, with people that are out there doing the work, that's one way to help them create a resilient campus, which is different than sustainable. And I thought it was pretty visionary that they wanted us to help them with that, not because that's what we want to help people be prepared for, especially those that are in service to others. So
yeah, that is fantastic. And when we think about resilience, and you mentioned sort of rainwater harvesting, we could think about fortifying, making more robust, less fragile, our systems through technology and structures and things like putting solar on our rooftop, which I have. It feels really good not to be dependent on TEP or any utility for our power. We do depend on them, frankly, for nighttime electricity, but we could go out and get a battery, I suppose. And then it doesn't matter what happens, as far as that goes. But then, is that enough? Should I only care what's happening with my family on my lot? Absolutely not.
Right.
We are an entire community, and in fact, having spent most of my first part of my life in South America, we're a global community. and we have differences, but one thing for sure is our basic desires in life are the same. It doesn't matter where we come from. And being able to withstand shocks is certainly one of them. There are others that have more to do with behavioral change. And this isn't about framing things in a way that, by the way, that that is, we're going to take things away from you. You're not allowed to do this or that. In fact, I think, you know, just between you and me, I think Hummers are hideous.
I'm with you, dude. I am with you. Thank you.
Arnold Schwarzenegger had two of them. One had a hydrogen fuel cell on it, and the other had completely electrical. Well, he can afford to do that because he just tells someone, you know, to build his Hummer that way. But that it was interesting because we think Hummers are hideous. Besides that, they're just not really good for the environment if they're burning fossil fuels. But I have a vision for a future where electricity power is literally free to everyone.
Wow.
And that's not out of the question. And here's how I know that. Water is literally free in a desert, literally free in Arizona.
True. All we pay for is
the
delivery.
The molecule. Exactly.
Right.
And I'm imagining it. Why do I say that? I have solar on my rooftop. I actually produce more than I actually use. And so TEP gets the benefit of a little mini power plant over on my roof, and they send it off to other people. And so it's been paid off. You know, the cost of putting the infrastructure in, once that it's paid off, it's free. So imagine a society where electricity and power is free. Well, that is a more resilient system. It's a more resilient and ideally a more equitable one if we do this correctly. But part of our problem is that we don't care as much about our neighbors as we do ourselves. We don't care as much about the people on the Indian reservation as we do ourselves, or people in other countries. And so as a people, I'm not one of these that thinks it's a zero-sum game. I think that all boats can rise if we think about it right. I'm not suggesting that we make sure that everyone has equal wealth, although not a bad idea. But I'm not suggesting that. We don't have to do it that way. We can do it so that the basic necessities can be met by the entire population. And that's a more resilient society. We think that resilience happens when 1% of the U.S. population owns more than 50% of the wealth. That's not resilient. There is going to be a shock to that system.
I hope you're right. I do hope you're right. It's pretty. Well,
we might not be alive when it happens, but it will happen.
That's true. Know? But hopefully we'll be at least smiling that we see it in the future. I see a lot of old paradigms crumbling locally, globally, nationally. So let's hope. We have done such a great job on staying on track, and I have loved your answers. But there's a couple of other things I want to get to that are themes of air. We will be covering them in the subsequent five podcasts, if not more. And two of them, I think, would be of interest to our listeners and kind of don't always fit in the normal conversation around sustainability and resilience. And one of the themes is national security and the environment. And some people are very able and very quickly to draw the connection. Why is that one of the major themes of the ones you picked? It's so important, and I know the answer because you told me, but why is that one of the themes?
Well, in fact, I don't remember which answer I told you, so I'm going to tell you two of them.
I always believe you.
One is there's a lot of really good literature and clear evidence that stressed environments stress people, and stressed people, there's unrest. It's conflict, unrest, national security issues, either locally or more broadly. But you can imagine, I'll just give you one example. Imagine when, because it's a when, 80 million Bangladeshis have to find a new home because sea level rise has caused their country to be underwater, one third of their country to be underwater. What's going to happen then? They got to go somewhere. And so conflict and security is really important because of the connection with environment. When the environment cannot produce the food that people need or supply the water that people need, that they go find it. And conflict arises from that. Another is, and this is connected to fossil fuels. There's a book that a friend of mine, Terry Tamminen, used to be the director of the California EPA. And he wrote I think it's called something like Lives Per Gallon, The Real Cost of Oil. And what he does is he goes through and calculates and guesstimates, with logic behind it, there's nearly $1 trillion subsidy of oil in this country. And so when we think we're spending $2.50 at the gallon, that's what we give the person at the gas station per gallon. But we're actually spending over $13 a gallon. We are actually spending it. We just don't see it at that moment because it comes through taxes and subsidies that these fossil fuel companies have been given. The biggest part of that difference between $13 and $2.50 is the cost of national security. So if you imagine that a significant fraction of what we spend on defense in this country, and now it's up to $750 billion a year that we spend on defense, and a big part of it is to secure our access to oil that is under other people's sand. And imagine a time when, going back to the solar on my rooftop, and yes, we people can argue the challenges that remain. The challenges are not scientific or technical or even economic. It's just a challenge of willingness and who's in charge of the decisions at the moment. Because if we are producing what we need in for our energy, we're not having to spend that kind of money on security. So, and then the third is that the impacts of climate change actually affect our bases that we have, our military bases that we have in other countries. And those impacts are also important for us to notice. So there are at least three different ways, but there are quite a number of them we could look at. And so we think that we're equipped with the right kind of people and thinking and relationships to be able to really help address some of the, fill in some of those knowledge gaps and help address some of the solution options.
And I've spent a lot of time looking at the themes and the websites, and we can't go through all of them because that's why we're having a series. But another one that really struck me that's so important, and you've kind of touched on it, is data, informatics, and modeling, and artificial intelligence. And we're talking about big data mm-hmm. in helping us develop the future. So whose bucket does that fall in at the U of A, Arizona mm-hmm. Institutes of Resilience? That's a big one, Jim, and it matters so much.
Well, it is a big one. So if you're looking for a next career, come on over and run it for us. So one of the things that we should outline right now is that AIR is not about owning disciplines or fields
right.
within AIR. It's about being able to encourage and motivate this kind of work and these kinds of organizations throughout the entire university. So on that one, we've been working with the folks. There's something called Cyverse. It's a program of big data and machine learning, artificial intelligence, a program at the university, and working with those folks, we're imagining a collection of all of the different kinds of data that you might imagine that we would need to be able to address resilience. And the beauty of what happens at Cyverse is that the data sets are organized in such a way that essentially the data talks to each other. We can query the data sets not just across a disciplinary way, like tell me what the average temperature is. No, It's what is happening with the snowbirds coming to Arizona as climate changes. That's a much more it's a question that is that requires a lot of different kind of data sets. And if you have the data sets that are working together and that you can query them in those ways, they're much more accessible. And so it's across the disciplines, across the way, modes of data. Imagine biological data, physical science data, climate data, social science data, geography data, all coming together under one. And then the machine learning part is super interesting because the ability for computers to be able to organize data. I mean, imagine, for example, I mean, just what we do when we say, oh, I'm going to go Google that. Well, what happens is a machine, we just query the machine as to who is Gina Murphy Darling. And within a millisecond, up pops the probably 1.5 million references to Gina Murphy Darling.
I wish.
And now we know we can learn about Gina Murphy Darling. That's a tiny little example. It's not even fair to what is possible. But again, that's working with the people within the university. We've realized that it needs to be a priority if we're going to be able to address some of those super complex questions that we have.
Another perfect segue, I kid you not, because we're getting close to the top of the hour. And I never play Stump the Guest, and you and I have had hours of conversation with other people about this one. At the end of the day, what our listeners want to know is, this is great information, I learned a lot, but how do we bring all of this together to feed my family, to help me get a new job, to keep a roof over my head? How is the important work you're doing helping all of us to have a better life? And obviously, I believe it is, but how would you answer that? You're the expert here.
I'm going to be really flip here. We're taking care of the resilience of the planet so that you can focus on feeding your family.
I love it. Oh my God, that's a great answer. It is. I don't want to have to worry about it.
Exactly. And what we're trying to do, again, it isn't like academics have all of the answers, but what we do have is we have a mission, and we're getting paid to think about these things and make these connections, come up with the solutions, and so that people can focus on the things that are important in their lives and to be able to answer questions, like very specific questions. What can I do? I remember a guest that you had on a couple of years ago, and I'll get it wrong, so I'll just paraphrase the question that you asked: how can people be most impactful? And your host said, run for public office.
Oh yes! Oh my God!
And promote these sustainability and resilience themes. And so the questions that people have about what can I do range from that. I mean, not everyone could, you know, heaven forbid, some of us vote, run for public office. But what we can do, my wife owns a restaurant in downtown Tucson. Once you showed me and her what the damage that plastic, single-use plastic straws were doing, she immediately went out and got the other kind of straws so that she isn't doing that. And she took it a step further. She said, if I'm going to change out my plastic straws, I'm going to change out my to-go containers. I'm going to go as plastic less as I can. And so why? Because you inspired us. And that kind of inspiration will come out of the people that are working at AIR in so many different ways. And they'll happen increasingly so, because increasingly we're bringing in some of the younger people as our graduate students and undergraduate students to help us think about these things. You know, one of the friend of mine once said years ago, long before I was in higher ed, he said, you know, what happens to kids is that they start out school as a question mark, and by the time they're done, they're a period. We tend to lock ourselves into ways of thinking that undo our creativity. And we're trying to do that very differently within AIR and at the University of Arizona so that it isn't so.
What a great answer. And thank you for that. And Jim, it's all about the conversations I have with people about you don't go out and say, I'm going to change the world. You change what you're doing. And that can be with the end in mind, but you do that by changing one thing at a time. And then the world has already changed. So that keeps it from being overwhelming for me. So that was my last big brain question. And I want to know if there's anything else you are sitting there saying, Gina, aren't you going to ask me that? Because you can pop up and say it. I know we have a lot more to cover in subsequent podcasts with other guests, but is there anything that's nagging at you that you want to add?
Probably one thing I'll tell you a little bit about how we think that we're moving in the right direction within the Institute. We've laid out for ourselves operating principles for ourselves, and just to cover not all of them, but just a few. So I referred to this a little bit earlier, our approach is a systems approach. And you hear a lot of people talk about, what does that really mean? Well, it's less about individual sections of an issue, a problem, or a challenge, or even a discipline or a theme. It's really the connections between. And that's recently, relative in the last 5 years, people have moved from saying, okay, we're going to study water, or we're going to study food, or we're going to study energy. We talk now about the food, energy, water system, because they are all interrelated. And in fact, we could go on, but the acronym would be way too long if we added all of the other ones that are part of the system. And it's, what are the cascading kind of effects between, say, water and energy and food, as just that example. So it's connecting the humans and the natural systems, interrelationships between sectors or disciplines or fields. And that is critically important. And you'll see that when you look at our themes, right? They aren't, you don't see biology. Biology you see throughout.
Right, you do not see that.
Yeah, you don't see physics, but you see physics throughout. So we've addressed the themes from a sort of a social, environmental challenge piece, and then we organize the people around solutions, arriving at solutions to the challenges that are in those areas. And then, I just mentioned solutions. So if we just think in terms of providing research, science-based options for policy. Now, we get to say that starting this week.
I know.
We weren't allowed to say that for the last 4 years. Don't understand that. Or maybe we were allowed to say it, but no one was listening in D.C.
And you might get in trouble depending upon what your job was.
Yeah, that's very true. But trouble's my middle name. But solutions not just for policy, but for markets and for communities, because, again, we don't actually take things to scale in universities. We test them in a lab. We prototype them. Then we pass them off. Doesn't mean it isn't still our job to help implement, but we simply aren't going to be as impactful unless we partner with policy makers and businesses and community organizations. And then another thing that we didn't talk about, and we can circle back around in a year or so, it's about having impact. I have a 27-year-old son that is now 5 years into his career as an engineer, most of the time when we talk, he talks about how he wants a job where he can actually make an impact. And he's not alone. His generation is about making an impact. And they're willing to give up the kinds of things that perhaps you and I, as we were their age, not willing to give up. And our impact, we see it as through transcending incrementalism. We're about incrementalism within the university, but we want to transcend that. So otherwise, how else are we going to have true impact? The other issue is communication. We didn't talk about that, but I actually don't think, like, for example, with energy and then the dream of having a free energy for all, it's not a technology problem. It's not a science problem, but it's in fact it's not even an economic problem. It's just a communications, it's a behavioral, it's a change problem. And I think that that's communication serves a critical, important role. And AIR has embraced that. We have an entire communications strategy and people working on it. The last thing I'll just say is that this is hard, and people are there's very little bandwidth, and it's really hard to take on big challenges, take on extra. We're always asking of our faculty to take on a little bit more, and can you do a little bit more? And we have to think about how do we best motivate, and what we are looking for, and we found within the University of Arizona, that's why I'm such a huge fan, what I'm calling a coalition of the committed, or a coalition of the enthusiastic, people that are truly enthusiastic about coming together within the university, with organizations like your own, Gina. Critically important to be able to do that, and we need to have the folks that are truly enthusiastic about working on these hard problems. So
true. Oh my gosh, so true. So one of the things I love about this show is that I get the last word. And sometimes I just still have fun saying that. So just take a deep breath, and I know you don't like people to sing your praises, but I'm the show host, so there you go. Jim Beiser is one of my favorite people on the planet, and there are lots of reasons for that. He's a dynamo, he's brilliant, he's fun and funny, he can really be irreverent, his brain never stops, and it's really exciting to be around him. He's driven to make a difference because he really does care about the health of the planet, about his family, and about all of us. To that end, he and his team are relentless in their commitment to bringing people together to solve some of the biggest challenges we have ever faced as a civilization. And I can't emphasize that enough. He's working with people at AIR and around the globe to find solutions to our climate crisis, the very real, clear, and present and ongoing danger of climate change. He wants to share them far and wide and to make real change happen. And quickly, let's do it and ship it and get it out there. And all that matters to me. And it's why my team and I are so excited about this series and the work of AIR and its impact. But what I want to leave you with is the reminder that you, the listener, are needed for resiliency. And Jim said that, and I didn't even coach him. We are all needed to create resilient communities. It's up to us to listen for the lessons we've learned from these podcasts and will learn, and then figure out how each of us can take those lessons, apply them to our own lives, and inspire others to do the same. To me now, it's a two-step process. It's doing the two-step. You do it and hopefully inspire others to do the same. It's essential. I'm among the millions of Americans who is willing and shameless in quoting poet laureate Amanda Gorman, who spoke at the inauguration last week. And I know that we will be quoting her for weeks, months, and years to come. But this is the takeaway. This is the message we need to keep saying to ourselves over and over and over again, because there are some dark days ahead. I do believe that. There is always light. Only if we are brave enough to see it, only if we are brave enough to be it. And my voice did crack. I haven't been able to say that without it. But I'm really glad that now there are people in the White House that their voices crack too. I'm not ashamed of it. So thank you all for being a part of my world. Jim Beiser, thanks for showing up in my world. And everybody, just get out there and be brave enough to be it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.